We are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. I'm Jonathan, and today I'll be joined by David Sachs. David is one of the founders of PayPal and acted as COO during his tenure there. After PayPal, David started Yammer and sold that to Microsoft in 2012 for $1.2 billion. David now works at Kraft Ventures, an early stage venture fund he started in 2017. So now let's get to the bottom line. So I kind of want to start off the interview with talking a little bit about your background. So you were born in Cape Town, South Africa, and immigrated to Memphis, Tennessee when you were five, and then attended Stanford. After going to Stanford, you went to UChicago for law school. Was that kind of because you were considering a legal career or because you kind of wanted to have the benefits of a legal education?
Well, back in those days, there wasn't really a track for people who wanted to do something entrepreneurial. In fact, law school was sort of the default path for smart people who are good at school who didn't really know what to do with their lives. No one really does that today, but back then, a lot of people just went to law school because it was the next degree to get. And so I think that was what was going on with me to some degree. I was interested in business. I knew I wanted to get into business. That's why I ended up getting a job at McKinsey out of law school. But there was some sense of wasn't sure exactly how to do it. And law school is just kind of the next degree to get. I think today it's very different. There's just a lot of more direct ways to go about getting into something entrepreneurial.
So for kind of going off that, for somebody my age, what would you recommend if they're interested in VC or startups? Like, how would you break into the space?
Well, if you're interested in VC or startups, just go directly work at a startup. That would be my suggestion. Go work at the best startup you can. And specifically, I would judge it based on the quality of the founders. You really want to work at a startup where the founders are people you can learn from. And hopefully, you're working closely with them. If you can, you don't want to join the company too late stage. It's not a startup anymore. You won't really get that experience. But if you can go work for great founders, and obviously it's hard to identify who they are if you're not familiar, but if you can work for great founders as one of the first 50 or 100 employees of a startup, I think that's the right kind of experience if you yourself want to be a founder of a startup. I wouldn't go work at an investment bank or a consulting firm like McKinsey, like I did, because I just think like those types of business experiences are just very different. Startups and even VC investing is very, very different than other kinds of investing. And so you just want to go directly into that area if that's what your long-term goal is.
Yeah, that makes total sense. You mentioned McKinsey. So you started off your career there before making the switch to PayPal. How did you go about making that decision to kind of leave the job security of McKinsey to join a startup? And I'm kind of curious to learn a little bit more about how you went about that decision. Like, was it always your plan?
No, I mean, well, first of all, I went to McKinsey out of law school because I was interested in business. And then McKinsey seemed like a great way to transition from law school into business. They were recruiting not just from the business school, but also from law schools and from other kinds of graduate programs. And so it was a good transitional move. And I learned, I went through a training program at McKinsey that was a really interesting, almost like mini MBA. From there, what basically happened is, I got a call from my friend from Stanford, Peter Thiel, who was telling me about the startup he was building. This was back in 1999. It was called Confinity back then, and the idea was to beam money from one Palm Pilot to another. I thought it was kind of a dumb idea because there are only 5 million Palm Pilots in the world, and why would you need to beam money between Palm Pilots? But in the course of these conversations, which happened over a few months, we discussed the idea, well, what if you could email money? That seems like a killer app. There were something like 250 million email users at that point, on the way to billions. And I just thought it would be a killer idea if you could email money. So I told him if that's what the idea is going to be, we didn't use the word pivot back then, but what we were basically talking about was a pivot. I said, I'll join the company if that's what, the idea is going to be. And so I ended up joining, partly because it was my friendship with Peter that gave me the opportunity, but also I thought this idea of emailing money was a really strong idea.
Yeah, so you mentioned Peter Thiel. PayPal had kind of a really unique setting where it was really an unparalleled group of people for a startup. It had Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Reid Hoffman, Steve Chen. What was the culture like? Was it more of a flat organization? And what would you say was like the secret sauce in the hiring process that allowed you to create such a special group of people?
Well, I think one of the reasons why you got such a concentration of entrepreneurial talent is because we didn't use headhunters by and large. It was all the recruiting was done by a friendship network. So Peter recruited the people he knew from Stanford, like me. I recruited my friends. Max Levchin, who was the CTO, recruited his friends from U of I, where he had gone to school, and so on down the line. And the main reason why we recruited that way is because this is back in the late 90s. It was really hard to convince anyone to drop out of a professional track at a bank or consulting firm or law firm or something like that and join a startup, especially a startup run by, a bunch of folks in their 20s who hadn't done anything before. So startups were perceived as being incredibly risky in those days. And it was just hard to get anyone to want to join. So we sort of recruited our friends out of necessity. But because of that, the early team was sort of, there were people who were sort of cut from the same cloth. It was sort of like a very similar DNA. It was this sort of very entrepreneurial type of person. And then when PayPal got acquired and, eBay didn't make any effort to really retain any of the core people, they all went off on their own and did their own things. And it was the combination of the people sort of having this entrepreneurial DNA to begin with, plus all the things they had learned from PayPal. They had learned all these playbooks around virality and sort of product development, iterating on the product, hacking growth, all those kinds of lessons. And then, finally the timing, it was in 2002 when the company got acquired, and it was one of the only successful outcomes, after that dot-com crash period, which began in the early 2000s. So you had this group of very entrepreneurial people who knew all the playbooks, who then went off on their own at a time when everyone else was retreating and leaving Silicon Valley. And that paved the way for the PayPal Mafia to become this sort of really influential group that defined the next generation of startups. In some way, we had the field kind of all the way, sort of all to ourselves. The only other company that I think is even, remotely analogous would be a company called Fairchild Semiconductor in the 1950s, which paved the way for all the chip companies in Silicon Valley. You had, the early team at Fairchild went off and created, all the important sort of hardware companies in Silicon Valley in the 50s and 60s. But yeah, it's been interesting to see that there hasn't really been another PayPal Mafia. That's been pretty interesting to see on its own. I mean, Google, you look at the number of people that Google had pre-IPO, and it's thousands of them. PayPal only had 200 or so people in the Silicon Valley office pre-IPO, and you look at how prolific the PayPal Mafia has been. It's more prolific than the Google Mafia, even though Google had, an order of magnitude more people involved.
That's so interesting to hear about. So kind of after like PayPal, you founded Yammer and you sold it to Microsoft and one of their largest acquisitions ever. I'm really curious to kind of learn a little bit more about why you decided to transition from founding companies to investing in them.
Well, I got to a certain point, this is about 5 years ago, where I just didn't want to run companies on a day-to-day basis. And there's a certain sameness to it. And I felt like I'd already done it before multiple times. That being said, I still love technology, helping to create cutting-edge products, being involved in the tech ecosystem. So if you're not going to be a founder, there aren't that many other paths. If you want to be, and so the other one is really being an investor. And if you just want to be an advisor, that makes you an investor as well, because the business model for an advisor in this business is basically being an investor. That's kind of the way it works. So there's really only a couple of tracks, and investing is something I've been doing throughout. While I was, creating my own company, Yammer, I was also an angel investor and had a successful track record over the last 2 decades. I think I'd invest in something like, 25 unicorns. And so when I decided to do it full time, I decided at that point to take on partner capital, which is basically what, VC fund is, just so we could write bigger checks. And then that brought us to where we are today.
As a former founder, I'm a little curious to see how would you describe your investing strategy? Would you say you place more emphasis on like management of portfolio companies, or do you place the majority of your focus on the product?
Well, both those things are very important. I mean, there's another thing we look at, which is SaaS metrics. So I've basically have focused on, for the most part, on investing in software companies, which are generally B2B. You know, you're selling software to businesses or enterprises, and that's a great part of the market because, you know, business is always changing, which means that you need new software. Software is always changing, and businesses are willing to pay for that software. Consumers, it's very hard to get them to pay, which is why, you know, the biggest consumer businesses are typically ad supported. But businesses, enterprises are different. They're willing to pay a lot of money for software if it genuinely helps them, if there's an ROI there. And my startup Yammer was an enterprise software company. The thing that was different about it relative to what it had come before is that we used the consumer growth, sort of growth hacking tactics, the viral tactics that we had figured out at PayPal and applied them to enterprise software. No one had really done that before. Before Yammer, there was a sharp divide between, you know, what consumer startups looked like and what enterprise startups looked like. And there was a completely different set of tactics and playbooks. And what we did at Yammer was start to break those walls down and say, well, wait, we can actually make enterprise software go viral inside enterprises. You see a lot of companies doing that today. But back in, this is 2008, that was a pretty novel idea. In any event, since Yammer, I've been principally focused on B2B software. And so that's what I invest in. And one of the things we pay a lot of attention to is the metrics. These types of companies are highly quantifiable. And so we've actually, you can read my blog, and I've got a blog post called The SaaS Metrics That Matter. And we've done a fair amount of work in defining like what those metrics are that a founder would want to look at and use. And by the same token, we use them as investors. So that's probably the first piece of it is, you know, when you're talking about a Series A or B, you're gonna, you know, see, ask what are the metrics, and they kind of hit our thresholds. And then on top of that, you're gonna want to assess what's the quality of the founder. I would say founder more than management team, because the founder will build the management team, and obviously we're gonna, you know, do a product demo and, you know, and use the product and see what we think of that, and then that will all play into an overall assessment of how big an outcome do we think this can be, and that will all go into it.
Yeah, so you talk a lot about kind of the metrics you look at. Do they depend kind of on the market cycle? Like if the economy is doing really well, like do you focus on certain metrics more than others?
I would say for us, no. I think the valuation levels depend on the market cycles. We sort of figure out what companies we want to be in, and then the valuations that we pay tend to be set by the market. You know, we're just one player in the market, and if we don't offer a competitive valuation, founders will go elsewhere. So the market for venture capital is always in a state of calibration based on what's happening in larger capital markets. And so right now, as you might expect, valuations are much lower because everyone's looking at the public comps. So you just look at like, well, what are SaaS companies trading at now? I mean, the typical SaaS company is trading at like 6 or 7 times ARR, whereas a year ago it was trading at 15 to 30 times. So that multiple compression means that the eventual exits are going to be smaller, which means you can't pay as much now. So valuation levels go down or up with the state of how frothy or depressed the market is. But what metrics we use to look at evaluating a business don't change. I mean, or they shouldn't change if you're doing your job as an investor, right? Because, your assessment of a company should be based on that company, not, you know, macroeconomic conditions. Now, I do think that, you know, although I wouldn't necessarily put us in this category, I do think there are a lot of investors who in boom markets, all they do is look at top line revenue, and it's just about growth, growth, growth. And when all of a sudden you're in a bust cycle like we are now, all of a sudden people look at other things. And so it's not, they still look at growth, but it's growth, margins, and capital efficiency or burn. And companies that, you know, achieve high growth, but if they do it through basically negative margins or through burning too much money, those companies are second guessed in a bust cycle. Whereas in a boom cycle, no one's paying attention to burn or to margins. They're just looking at the top line revenues. So I do think that is a mistake that's pretty prevalent in the VC world. I mean, hopefully we don't do it, but you do see it quite a bit.
Awesome. I want to kind of transition a little bit more to talking about the investing landscape as you kind of currently see it. Mm-hmm. So like since 2008, there's been really a market difference in Fed policy. So with the market having recovered, the Fed continued quantitative easing in the ensuing years and really just recently stopped with the benefit of hindsight much too late. Do you think we should have confidence that they're going to get it right going forward?
Well, they definitely haven't gotten it right over the last 10 years. So no, I don't have a lot of confidence in them getting it right moving forward. So you may recall about, it was last summer around May where we got this surprise inflation print. I think the number at that time was 5.1%. And everybody is like, whoa, what's going on here? Because inflation had been, you know, roughly around 2% or less for years. And in fact, the Fed had been warning, you know, in the year or two prior to this, that deflation was a big risk. And they were going to try and engineer the inflation rate up, above 2%. And so everyone was kind of hit by surprise by this inflation print. And then you had both the Fed and the administration basically say it was transitory. And they basically stuck to that party line for at least 6 months. And it wasn't until the end of the year around December where they started to say that it might be persistent. During that time, they were still easing. I mean, they were still using quantitative easing, and interest rates were basically at zero or near zero. And, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, they should have taken their foot off of the accelerator immediately. As soon as we had that 5.1% print, what they should have done was stop quantitative easing right away. Why would you be easing into, you know, an inflationary situation? I think the Fed forgot that QE was never supposed to be standard operating procedure. It was something that was invented back in 2008 to prevent, you know, Great Depression II. I mean, it was invented to prevent the Great Recession from turning into a depression. And it did work in that respect, but the policy continued way too long. I mean, for a whole decade, to the point where people just stopped paying attention to it. They started to think it was normal. And then what you see is that this year, starting basically in January, when the markets finally realized that the Fed would shift into this more austerity mode, the market's been like going down ever since, because basically the market got hooked on drugs. It got hooked on these like super low interest rates, the so-called ZIRP, the zero interest rate policy. And they started to think that these low interest rates would last forever. And so all their DCF models were based on like absurdly low interest rates. Well, now all of a sudden you start modeling in, you know, 4 or 5% long-term inflation rates instead of, you know, like 1% or 0%, whatever. And then that creates a massive repricing of equities. So that's what you've seen happen this year. So yeah, I think we all got lulled into a false sense of security around Fed policy, interest rate policy. You know, one of my big takeaways is that even though I'm not a macro investor, I'm the ultimate micro investor, meaning, you know, I'm investing in companies that are just barely getting started. And, you know, I thought that all I really had to worry about was whether I'm doing the picking correctly on this specific company, this specific idea, this specific founder. It's basically as micro as it gets. But as it turns out, we were also affected by this macro policy that was being set by the Fed. So I don't want to have to keep an eye on what the Fed is doing, but I think we're all going to have to now because we've learned what a huge impact it has on equity prices.
Kind of going off that, I remember, I think it was in, correct me if I'm wrong, 2018, there was a bit of like a quote unquote taper tantrum when the Fed announced they were going to taper kind of quantitative easing a little bit. Do you think going forward that quantitative easing is going to be kind of normalized into the economic cycle and kind of like the way Fed does policy? Or do you think after this latest fiasco, it's going to become less prevalent?
I think it's going to become a tool that they use. I'm still not sure they know how to use it correctly, but, once an emergency measure gets created, it tends to be normalized. This is the thing with not allowing government to create certain kinds of emergency measures. I mean, you saw like during COVID with lockdowns, it was supposed to be 3 weeks to stop the spread, and the lockdowns lasted a year, even though they weren't helpful. People get, Milton Friedman once said, there's nothing quite so permanent as a temporary government program. So these things tend to last a lot longer than they should. In any event, I think that we're not, I think we're unlikely to see QE in the near term. I think what the Fed has said actually is they're going to do QT, which is quantitative tightening. They want to unload all these assets off their balance sheet. The problem is, and this is another stupid thing about Fed policy, if they knew they're going to need to unload all these assets off their balance sheet, why wouldn't they have done that first before they jacked up interest rates so suddenly? Because basically, by jacking up interest rates so quickly, they've made all these assets toxic. I mean, they've got all this like debt that's worth, all these bonds that are worth a lot less now because thanks to their own interest rate policy, the price of a bond moves inversely to interest rates. So they've decreased the value of all these assets. In hindsight, what they should have done, I think, starting last summer was immediately, maybe not raise interest rates yet. They could have waited to see if inflation was in fact persistent, but they should have immediately stopped QE and maybe start to shed some of these assets off their balance sheet. And then that would have sucked liquidity out of the market and maybe achieved the desired effect of reducing inflation without having this sort of whipsaw effect where all of a sudden we've gone from like 0 to 4% in, interest rates.
So I kind of want to transition a little bit to thinking about from the different investing spheres. So you have the last decade or so, it feels as though the barriers between VC investing, PE, and public investing have come down. You've seen a lot more hedge funds entering the PE and VC space. Do you think that trend's likely to continue? Or do you think some of the hedge funds kind of getting burned this year from doing that is going to lead to a market change in investing strategies?
Yeah, I mean the big thing you saw over the last couple of years in the VC world were these so-called crossover investors. Investors from outside the VC world, from typically the hedge fund world, and they were getting into VC in a bigger and bigger way. And so, Tiger was the most noteworthy of these investors, but there are others too, like Coatue and D1 and so forth. I think the way they got there, I think it happened in the following way. Let's imagine that you're a public market investor, and specifically, you're investing in SaaS, you're investing in software companies, and you're seeing that the public markets are valuing, a high growth SaaS company at, say, 30 times ARR for, like a 40%, grower, which is where things were in 2021. N now that number is more like 8 times, but in 2021, it was 30 times. Next 12 months revenue for a company growing 40% year over year. So now you're an investor in that market and you're looking at the last private round that happened before the IPO. And it's, you can look at that and say, wow, these people got in, these late stage VC investors got in at a $1 billion valuation and I'm paying 30 in the public markets. And they just did that like 2 years ago. That seems like an unbelievable return. So they moved earlier. So they started getting into that last private round. Then once they're sitting there in that last private round, they're looking at the second to last private round and they're saying, well, wait a second, those guys got in, at $250 million valuation a year before. So that's like a 4x return and it looks pretty risk-free. So what happened is these guys started moving earlier and earlier based on the perceived arbitrage of going from public to private valuations. And so they moved in a very heavy way. A lot of dollars started flooding and that drove up VC valuation significantly. And Tiger by itself moved the market tremendously over the last couple of years. I would say that growth stage valuations roughly doubled, if not more, because of the Tiger effect. Because if you don't want to lose deals to just based on price, if you're a growth stage investor, there's only a certain number of companies you want to be in. And historically, it's been more important to be in the right companies than it's been to sort of, nickel and dime over price. So, Tiger forced everyone else to pay more to be in the companies they want to be in. In any event, that was a dynamic over the last few years, is huge amounts of new money coming into venture driving up valuations. Well, now what's happened is that you look at this crash we've had in the stock market, and specifically in growth stocks. So, you know, if people are just looking at the indices like the Dow Jones or like the S&P 500, you're going to miss actually how big a crash this was, because the S&P might be down 20 something percent, but growth stocks are down 70, 80, 90%, you know, and the recent IPOs, the SPACs, the newer listings, the more risky the company, the bigger the correction's been. I mean, again, 70, 80, 90%. So, and, you know, I talked about the multiple compression going from 30 times to 7 or 8 times. I mean, you're talking about 80%, you know, reduction in multiples. So there's been a massive, massive correction. And so that now, you know, frankly, a lot of those late stage investors who came in, like the crossover investors, are kind of licking their wounds right now. And that has created a contraction in the amount of capital that's been available in VC markets. It's now valuations are going back down. So so everyone kind of got whipsawed a little bit by what's happened over the last couple of years. But it all goes back to the Fed policy, right? Because if the Fed hadn't flooded the zone with liquidity, you wouldn't have gotten this asset bubble in the public markets. And then that asset bubble in publics drove, you know, this perceived arbitrage into VC. And then that created the liquidity flood into VC as well. So you see how destructive it is to asset up, having correct asset allocation, correct capital allocation, when the Fed doesn't set the right price of money and creates too much liquidity in the system.
Going into that a little bit deeper, how would you describe kind of what you're seeing in the markets right now with different companies that you're investing in? It sounds like there's less competition out there. Like, is the opportunity set more appealing to you now than it was, say, a year or two ago?
Well, there is less competition, but a VC is always competitive. You know, never stops being competitive. You still have to be on your toes, really looking for great companies. It's true the valuation levels are lower, but doesn't mean that it's easy to find great companies. You're always still looking for that needle in a haystack. When you find it, you know, typically, you know, what I always say is we're looking to be in the right companies. We're not looking for value per se. We're looking for great companies, whether it's in good markets or bad. We're price takers. We just pay the prevailing valuation that we need to get into a company. I don't see our job being to negotiate the best deals to get into the best companies. So it's still competitive. You know, one of the things that happens in an environment like this is that founders who don't need to raise, because let's say they raised last year and still have a lot of cash in the bank, they're not going to go out and raise an optional round because it's more dilutive than it was last year. So what you're seeing right now is less overall liquidity in the market. Fewer deals are happening because, again, founders who don't need to raise aren't going out, and they're going to kind of wait it out and see. Now, eventually, you know, probably towards the end of this year or next year, there will be a lot more companies that just have to raise because they need the capital. And then we'll see what happens. You'll see if the markets are in the state they're in right now, they haven't improved. You're going to see what's called structure in a lot more deals, meaning you're going to see either down rounds, or you're going to see founders seek to preserve a valuation that was maybe set, you know, at a market peak that can't really be justified today. But what they'll do is they'll give the investors more favorable terms, like, you know, liquidation preferences and things like that. Those are not deals we like to do. We'd rather invest in just simple, clean terms at the right price. But you're going to start to see wonky things like that happen if market conditions like we have today persist.
I want to transition to politics for a little bit. You've been very outspoken about a variety of political topics. Have you always had an interest in politics, or is it kind of a more recent involvement, more of a reaction to you being concerned with the direction the country's headed?
Well, I think there were a couple of things for me. One is I started doing this podcast a couple of years ago called The All In Pod. And what happened is, you know, we were all locked in our homes because of COVID back in, you know, around March of 2020. I started doing this pod with a few friends, and it was a way for us to see each other, talk, hang out. You know, we just recorded, we did it by Zoom, recorded it, and then published it. And somehow it became kind of a like a hit in the podcast world. We get about a quarter of a million views every week on YouTube, and then, probably twice that in downloads for the audio version. So that, that became sort of a platform. If you don't say what you think when you're recording on a weekly basis, there's nothing to talk about if you can't say what you think. We don't exclusively talk politics. It's kind of a current events show where we talk politics, markets, business, technology. I mean, really everything that's sort of current events, and but politics is part of that. So yeah, it has made me more outspoken than I was before. The other thing that's changed is that as a VC, I feel like I have more latitude to, let's say, alienate people who disagree. So in other words, like, we know the country's deeply divided over politics. If half the founders out there like me less, but half like me more, that's an okay to trade to make as a VC. I don't think that's a good trade to make when you're a CEO. So when I was running companies, I tried to avoid politics because I knew the country was deeply polarized, and I didn't want to bring that polarization into the company. I wanted everyone to be able to focus on just doing, on the company's mission. And I didn't, and I wanted to the employees to feel like I was a CEO for everyone in the company. I didn't want them to feel like I was taking positions they disagreed with. So I think it's appropriate for CEOs to generally stay away from politics so that they can be a CEO for their whole company. I think when you're a VC, it changes a little bit because you're not trying to do every investment in the world. And like this strategy has been successful for Peter Thiel for a long time. He's out there with his own views. They tend to be more libertarian. Libertarian founders are more drawn to him because of that. He may alienate other people, but he didn't need every deal in the world. And so I think in a similar way, I'm not seeking to lose anyone. I don't want to alienate anyone with my political views, and that's not what I'm going for. But it's just, I think, more acceptable as a VC to have views publicly versus as a CEO. Like, I would not advise CEOs to do what I've done, but I think it's more okay for a VC to do
You mentioned the podcast. My family and I are huge fans of it. They introduced it to me, and I've been kind of hooked ever since. So one of the main topics you kind of talk about, and it's personal to me as a college student, is the failure of higher education to represent a diverse set of political beliefs. Do you think it's gotten worse since you were at Stanford, and why do you think that is?
I think it's gotten worse because the progression's just continued. So, back when I was at Stanford, this is now, I'm dating myself, but it's like 30 years ago, they were in the process of, purging the curriculum and, the professoriate and so forth. So it was the beginning of a movement of basically an ideological takeover of the universities. I think that process was completed probably by the time soon after I graduated. And so you've had an entire generation of students now go through the universities where they've basically been, received, I think, an education that's like very, ideologized in a certain direction. And then they've gone out and then they've become, teachers and so forth. So you now see that a lot of the ideologies that were taught at Stanford and, the back when I was there, they're now pushed all the way down to high school and junior high school and so forth. And similarly, the graduates have gone out and occupied important positions in the nonprofit world, the foundation world, in corporate America. The so-called woke capitalism is a phenomenon you see now. If you look at polling, the biggest divide, and this is not me espousing a point of view, this is just data, the biggest divide in America is the single variable that determines where people line up on the political spectrum is whether they have a college degree or not. So if you have a college degree, you're a member of the so-called professional class. If you don't have a college degree, you're a member of the so-called working class. And there is a huge divide in this country between the views of the professional class and the working class. So that is the central friction in this country right now. Now, there are a lot more people in the working class. It's something like almost two-thirds of the country is working class, only one-third is professional class. But the professional class occupies all the high grounds of institutional power. So, there are very few people who don't have a college degree running large corporations or running foundations or think tanks or or Hollywood studios or the machinery of various parties. So the professional class has influence that goes way beyond their strict numbers. And so that produces friction. In a democracy, the views of the working class, they're the majority, but the views of the professional class are the ones that, again, control all the levers of power. So that's, to me, what the polling indicates. And the political scientist who writes the most about this is a Democrat named Roy Teixeira, who back in the early 2000s wrote a book called The Emerging Democratic Majority, in which he predicted the coalition that Obama would eventually use to become president. And he was heralded back then, you know, back when Obama was president, as a prophet who correctly foresaw that someone like Obama would become president. But if you read Teixeira over the last few years, he's been warning that the Democratic Party has actually lost the working class, that it's become a professional class party. It appeals to the views of college graduates as opposed to, say, you know, the lunch pail, blue collar, you know, union type worker, someone like that. And so there's always been a friction between the so-called beer track and wine track in the Democratic Party. But at this point, the wine track's completely won. Anyway, that's what Teixeira writes about. And so he has been bemoaning and concerned about the ways that the Democratic Party has lost touch with its working class roots. The Democratic Party at this point really represents the views of the professional class, and the Republican Party is in a state of transition of being this sort of country club chamber of commerce party to being a working class party. So politics are getting flipped upside down in this country. And I think that's what makes it confusing for a lot of people. If you want to understand this phenomenon better, I would read Roy Teixeira's Substack about it. And I think it's the best explanation of what of the kind of political strife we see in the country.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I don't have the statistic in front of me, but I think I read when I first got to Harvard, it was like 85% of the professors identify as very liberal, 10% as moderate, like 5% as conservative. So it's like even very, very...
The 5% are probably like 90 years old. I doubt there's any professors under 40 who identify that way. But it's the views of the professional class are shaped by their experience going to not just university, but all the prep schools. Because like I said, I mean, the thing that's happened since I was at Stanford is that all those graduates who were indoctrinated and ideologized in a certain way, many of them went off to become teachers. They may not become professors, but they became teachers at the lower schools. What's happened is that the things that I saw at Stanford really have just spread throughout society. So we now, it's kind of like a closed propaganda loop for anyone who grows up in this sort of professional class hegemony. I mean, if you're somebody who doesn't grow up in the working class, you grow up as someone who goes to elite prep schools and then elite colleges, then you join the Fortune 500, you're only going to be exposed to a certain kind of ideology and value set. And I think it's more of a closed loop now than it's ever been.
So I want to turn to you co-produced the movie Dali Land about Salvador Dali. Kind of what inspired you to delve into the movie business and what was the experience like?
Yeah, so the first movie I produced actually was back in 2005, 2006, I produced a movie called Thank You for Smoking, which was based on a book by that name by Christopher Buckley. And it was a satire of Washington politics and specifically political spin. The main character was a spin doctor for Big Tobacco. In any event, it was a comedy. You know, I think it's held up quite well as one of these sort of classic independent movies. Subsequent to that, we had a project in development about Salvador Dali, the painter. My interest in him, I just think he's a fascinating figure. He wasn't just a great artist. He was also a great performance artist. His life was almost like one of his works of art, where he would craft this persona, this really outrageous persona that where he would kind of embody surrealism. And he was also, if you see the movie, he was also a little bit of a con artist. I mean, he understood the art game, or at least the people around him did, and they knew how to take advantage of that to monetize the art world. So I thought he was a really interesting character. We brought the project to a director named Mary Herron. She and her husband, John Walsh, completely rewrote the script basically from scratch. And then they attracted Sir Ben Kingsley to play Salvador Dali, you know, Academy Award winning actor. And then the movie happened. It was one of these things that was in development for, you know, a dozen years. And then finally it happened when all the pieces came together. So We just premiered it at the Toronto Film Festival last weekend, and I think it turned out great.
Awesome. That's great to hear.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I wanted to kind of close with the question we ask all of our guests. What would you say is your hottest take?
Well, I have a lot of them, as you know from the podcast. Maybe this week's take would be, well, I've been saying this recently that I think 2024, I think there's a good chance. I think a lot of people are expecting 2024 to be a rematch between Biden and Trump. I actually think there's a good chance it's not going to be either one of them. It's going to be DeSantis versus Newsom. So the Florida governor versus the California governor. And it'll provide America with a real choice about which one of these sunshine states they want to emulate.
And who's the predicted winner for that?
I think DeSantis is going to win if it's that matchup, but I think those are the four players. I think it's possible that you could get a different matchup based on one or both parties deciding not to go with the fresh blood. And I do think that whichever party nominates fresh blood will win. And if they both nominate fresh blood, then I think it'll be DeSantis, at least based on the way things look today. Florida's doing a lot better than California.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please be sure to find us online at harvardventures.org. If you're a company or individual interested in working with us, email us at hello@harvardventures.org and follow us on Instagram at harvard_ventures. Tune in next week for another episode of The Bottom Line.